hopeful that things are still on for a long time, and just as we're giving you this answer, we'll return at the end of the time, which is then put at Avalon in Glastonbury, that's the normal version. The version around here is East Berry and the Mount Echo. The Strait of Messina, which is the strait between Sicily and mainland Italy, there's an effect there where you get an inversion of the current in the air at a certain temperature on certain days on a blue moon, and what happens is that a ship sails off and suddenly you don't see the ship on the ocean, you see it inverted in the sky and much larger.
Wow.
And they call this effect a Fata Morgana, which shows really the roots of that Celtic Arthurian reference here on Sicily. Fata Morgana means the fairy, more than a fairy, the bad fairy in the legends. So basically, they're saying, look what more than a fairy did. She was rather nasty thing. She took that shape, she turned it upside down. And I think that name has stuck for that kind of meteorological effect in other places around the world, but it was technically consistent. Apart from those few local references, there are more of those. In the main, the aristocracy were mugging them on mainstream Arthurian literature by writers such as Petion, to try out the first of the Arthurian writers around the 1960s. And Wolfram von Eschenbach, the second of, well, not the second, but another very major and important writer, particularly for the Sicilians, for reasons that we will appreciate. His patron was linked with Sicilian politics. We don't know much about the life of Wolfram von Eschenbach, except that he was a writer at the court of this particular person was living in Sicilian politics. Wolfram would have visited this island, and certainly there is that kind of mix of Muslim, Christian, Jewish sympathy within his text that you just don't get in most medieval literature. So it's one of the very few writers to pop his head up above the Christian parapet and one of the Muslim Jewish worlds down here. So, apart from those little introductions, let me give you 51 minutes of a presentation. Don't have my hour, I still need to be generous to travel. Here we go. So, enjoying celebrity status throughout Britain, Arthur is found in numerous places, from Arthur's Seat near Edinburgh to Arthur's Stone near Swansea and Arthur's Bridge in Somerset. Whether or not he was once a historical figure, as some believe, the chief importance of King Arthur lies in what he became, the central character in the matter of Britain. The collection of British myths and legends which bear this stamp. Recent attempts to deconstruct him as a historical Dark Ages warlord miss the historical point. For the Middle Ages which created him, he was an idealized figure, ruling an ideal society founded on the virtues of bravery and chivalry, courtesy and honor. It was only towards the end of the Middle Ages, with Malory's cycle of collected tales ending with the death of Arthur, that the elegiac note of moral decline began to predominate, with the foregrounding of the infidelity of Lancelot and Guinevere and the treachery of Mordred. Before that, for most of the medieval period, Arthurian knights were models of courtly, civilized behavior. In the Middle English Gawain and the Green Knight, for example. The ladies who receive Sir Gawain in a remote wilderness castle, far from Arthur's court, welcome him chiefly for the language and manners of court below that they now hope to see. Quote, each one quietly said to his neighbour, now we shall have the pleasure of seeing masterly displays of good manners and hearing the polished phrases of courtly discourse. That's what they like to learn, I see. Now poor Gawain struggled through the wilderness in torn, dishevelled figures, slaying monsters, and so we might be looking forward to a display of good manners. The major function of Arthurian romance then was to delight and instruct, to provide entertainment for a chivalric class and models for competition. But there was too a mysterious spiritual dimension to Arthurian literature which caught the medieval imagination, particularly in relation to the most arduous quest of Arthur's knights, the search for the Holy Grail. The story was first launched by the French writer Chrétien de Troyes in an unfinished poem titled Percival, or the Story of the Grail, written in the mid-1180s. As for the possible earlier origins of the tale, Chrétien tells us that he was asked by his patron, Count Philip of Flanders, to put into verse a book which Philip gave him, a fascinating allusion to a written source, no longer extant, if it ever existed, which has sent scholars scurrying into the hinterland of Celtic storytelling to find the original or clues to its existence. Why Celtic storytelling? Because that's where Arthurian literature first arises, in fantastic tales told about a hero called Arthur in early medieval Welsh literature. With analogues in Irish literature, for the most part, however, what remains of Celtic tales which mention Arthur amount to little more than fragments and scattered allusions, quite unlike the fully developed narratives of medieval Arthurian literature proper, which exist in numerous manuscripts in English, French, and German from the mid-12th century onwards. The search for significance in a Welsh and Celtic past is an avenue of scholarship that has now seemingly run its course, however, where scholars have wandered as in the valley of dry bones, picking up themes and images, variant names and narrative analogues, but not providing more than a rocky echo, largely barren of meaning so far as the later corpus of Arthurian literature is concerned. Perhaps the best to come out of this background, so far as the Grail story is concerned, is the mysterious 60-line Welsh poem found in an early 14th century manuscript but thought to be of much earlier origins, the Spoils of Annan, which describes a raid on the Celtic otherworld in which Arthur sets out to Caerseen with 3 boatloads of men, but only 7 return. While there, they find a mysterious cauldron rimmed with pearls, which we are told would not boil the food of a coward. A cauldron, which it is often said, may represent a tradition that evolved into the Grail legend with its similar focus upon marvellous vessels. But the argument is thin. The Grail, which is first encountered in Percival, is not a Celtic cauldron of plenty, but a shallow dish bears only a holy wafer. It is undoubtedly the case, rather, that post-Celtic Arthurian literature sprung most vigorously not directly from Celtic sources, but from a Latin work written by Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 1130s, The History of the British Kings, a work which took the hazy figure of Arthur, beloved by the Welsh, and turned him into the greatest British king ever known. It's sometimes called Geoffrey of Monmouth's revenge on history's text, because what actually happened was Arthur gets pushed into this very small class So, you know, you mentioned this year you've got a phrase. Actually, we have an enormous topic. This is actual realistic rivalry, not as Celtic stories as well. Because generally, the model very clearly stops its history around 500 AD. The Normans were quite happy to take on the greatest ever of European kings as one of their own. So, this is where European romance comes from this particular book. Well, as I said, it's actually a complete fiction which now became accepted as fact. Seeing Arthur as his great ancestor, the Norman king Henry II encouraged the spread of Geoffrey's history, prompting the writing of similar works in Anglo-Norman and tales of Arthur's knights in French, the first of which was Eric and Enid, composed by Chrétien in the late 1160s. Well, Eric and Enid was recorded in English, and the characters were so often Eric and Enid. Strange British writer, originally French. Well, within a few decades of Geoffrey's work, tales of Arthur's fame spread wherever the Normans spread, which was everywhere. Writing in 1177, Alarmus de Insulis remarks, quote, "What place is there within the bounds of the empire of Christendom to which has not extended the winged praise of Arthur the Briton? Who is there, I ask, who does not speak of Arthur the Briton, since he is but little less known to the peoples of Asia Minor, presumably, than to the Britons, as we are informed by our palmers who return from the countries of the East, these pilgrims bearing on coming back from the Middle East. The Easterns speak of him, as do the Westerns, though separated by the breadth of the whole earth. Egypt speaks of him," this is 1177, "Egypt speaks of him, and the Bosphorus is not silent. Rome, the queen of cities, sings his deeds, and his wars are not unknown to her former rival Carthage. Antioch, Armenia, and Palestine celebrate his acts." Well, astonishing though these claims may be, they are in fact largely supported by evidence. In reviewing the spread of Arthurian legends in medieval art, R.S. Loomis writes, quote, "As we shall presently see, an Arthurian scene was carved at Medina in the Po Valley, Italy, early in the 12th century, and in 1165, Arthur's figure was laid in mosaic, this is the picture you have, in Otranto, in the heel of Italy, along with such old timers as Alexander the Great, Noah. Early in the 13th century, it is recorded the legend that the British king was still alive and held court in the mountain fastnesses of Pentland, and in 1223, knights of the kingdom of Cyprus masqueraded as knights of the Round Table. This is still Loomis. Though knowledge of the Arthurian legends in Sicily and Cyprus is not attested until the 13th century, we may well believe that it had been familiar long before. So, widespread though these occurrences may be, they reflect a more focused reception of Arthurian legend than at first seems to be the case, however. For these early references to Arthur are not spread around Europe and the West in a broad scatter pattern, rather they come almost entirely from Norman territories, and to narrow them down further, they mainly come from the Norman crusader routes to Jerusalem, whether the land route via the Bosphorus and Turkey, or the sea route from southern Italy and Sicily via Cyprus to the Holy Land. So, who were the Normans, and what precisely was their interest in promoting the Arthurian material within a crusader context? With their base in Normandy in France, the Normans were descended
from the Viking conquerors of the area and its Frankish people. Emerging as a major military and cultural force in the 11th century, famously conquering England in 1066, and as we heard, moving into Sicily 20 years before that, around 1040. They also took this from the Byzantine Greeks, Malta, across the water, and Sicily, and Cyprus. They created a crusader state in Antioch at the end of the century in 1098, the Norman crusader state of Antioch, near Jerusalem. And the following year, they participated in taking Jerusalem from the Turks. Well, given its Norman distribution then, and particularly its distribution along Crusader routes, the spread of Arthurian material at an early date points to its function as an inspiring myth, mustering support for the Norman ambition to keep Jerusalem and the Holy Land in Christian hands. And moreover, this supposition is borne out by the fact that the patrons of Arthurian literature were those who had strong family interests in the success of the Jerusalem mission. Pretium was a major patron from the 1160s onwards, was Countess Mary of Champagne, the stepdaughter of Henry II, and a cousin of Philip of Flanders, whom we met a few moments ago as Pretium's patron for the Grail romance Percival. All of these figures owed their descent from their great ancestor, Fulk of Anjou, King of Jerusalem, from 1132 to his death in 1143. Philip's mother, named Philip of Flanders, patron of Anjou, Philip's mother, Sybil of Anjou, was Fulk's daughter, who made Jerusalem her home until her death in 1165. Philip himself was offered the Kingdom of Jerusalem during a visit there in 1177, but declined it. He died in 1191 at the Siege of Acre during the Third Crusade. At some time between his return from Jerusalem in about 1178 and his death in 1191, he gave Pretium the Book of the Grail, no longer extant, and asked him to put it into verse. The suggestion naturally arises then that the mysteries of the Grail belonged to the house of Anjou and played a part in its support for the Jerusalem mission. This suggestion is strongly supported by the work of Wolfram von Eschenbach, whose celebrated version of the Grail story, Parzival, appeared in around 1210. Taking Chrétien's Percival as his major source, Wolfram highlighted the Norman Anjou context of the story, telling us, for example, that Percival's father was Gameret of Anjou. More importantly, he tells us that the historical records of Anjou are the place where information about the Grail community is to be found. On the authority of an unidentified French poet called Caillot, Eschenbach says, quote, "The wise master Caillot embarks on a search for this tale, i.e. the tale of the Grail community. In Latin books, in order to discover where there may have been a people suited to keep the Grail and follow a disciplined life, he," says the wise master Caillot, "he read the chronicles of various lands in Britain and elsewhere, in France and in Ireland, but it was in Anjou that he found the tale." With this sentence, Wolfram directs our search for sources of the Grail story away from Celtic Britain to the old Carolingian duchy of Anjou. And this is by no means an isolated reference. Scholars have detected within the text numerous references to the history of the Anjou family between 1129 and 1195. And as we have seen, this is the family which owed its descent from Fulk of Anjou, King of Jerusalem, whose son Geoffrey Plantagenet, Count of Anjou, was the father of Henry II of England, who championed the Arthurian history. In Wolfram's conception, there is a royal family, the House of Anjou, and a great guardian order of monks, who he names throughout as Templisa, the Templars, who were linked with the House of Anjou through their major sponsor, Fulk of Anjou. The Arthurian scholar Margaret Ritchie notes that the shield of Galahad in the quest del Sangreal bears the famous Templar device, a red cross on a white ground, and adds, the same device is worn by Percival both in Gerbert de Montreuil's continuation of the Comte del Graal and in the latter part of Percival's Faust. It is moreover the badge of the holy folk introduced at the end of Percival's Faust, etc. The idea of an order of knights dedicated to the service of the Grail and associated with the order of the Knights Templar seems to me, on this evidence, to have been an integral part of the basic tradition. Well, with this mention of Templars, Grail seekers stand as a fork in the road. Do we take the road marked Templars on the assumption that the literary fiction of the Grail texts pointed to an actual, physical, magical object? If so, given that the Templars were spread throughout Europe in numerous enclaves before they were hunted down and driven out in the early 14th century, given that they were so widespread, this kind of search for the Grail could have been anywhere. And it did. The problem is well illustrated by a charming group called In Search of the Holy Grail and the Precious Blood, a Traveller's Guide, written by Ian and Dyke Begg, friends incidentally of Nicholas and Bridget from Nicholas Bridget Park, whom I met. They wrote this wonderful book, A Traveller's Guide to the Grail, published in 1995, basically going around the whole of Europe, picking up on these great stories of both Spain, Germany and so on. Generally linking them to this Templar tradition, the idea of the Templars has something to do with Grail, this is a treasure. So with this book in hand, the search for the Grail might take us very happily through the Grail castles of Germany, to Montserrat in Spain, or to Bosselin Chapel in Scotland, which recent writers have supposed to have been the Templars' bachelor, built to house the Holy Grail, as I'm sure you know. I was up there recently, and they told me they tripled their visitor numbers since Dan Bowles brought they've built on very expensive physical construction centre with the latest high-tech, other-design technology. They've got a host of guys up there, and what do you get inside? First, let's puzzle out what the Norman symbol stands for. And to do that, we need to turn away from the road marked Templars and take the path which is through the text of the original Grail stories themselves. I've seen this before, it's the wide shape of the road with the broad and easy path up to the chapel, Roslyn Chapel. We're now going to take the steep and narrow path through literary scholarship. That's where we have to look for the meaning of the Grail in your view. Yeah, we really need to look at some of the writers and some of their patrons. Count Philip of Flanders in the case of Chrétien, Herman of Thuringia in the case of Eschenbach. So here a search for the Grail becomes genuinely possible if we see it for what it is, not as a physical magical object, but as a symbol of a certain form of esoteric Christianity known as the House of Anjou, as Wolfram implies. This is what Wolfram says about the origins of the Grail story as it came down to him from a Provençal poet called Kant, who, as I said earlier, was not identified, so maybe a fiction. So Wolfram says, halfway through his book, he apologises for not having broached the matter earlier, but says, quote, Kant has simply considered it because his source forbade him to mention it till the story itself reach that point expressly where it has to be spoken of. The famous Master Kaios found the prime version of his tale in heathenish script, he found it in heathenish script, lying all neglected in a corner of Toledo, as historically accurate Arabic scripts were found in Toledo, translated. It helped him that he was a baptized Christian, otherwise this tale would still be unknown. No infidel art would avail to reveal the nature of the Grail and how one came to know its secrets. There was a heathen named Flegetanus who was highly renowned for his inquiries. This same Isidus was descended from Solomon, begotten of Israelitish king, all the way down from ancient times. He wrote of the marvels of the Grail. Flegetanus, he was able to define for us the recession of each planet and its return, and how long each revolves in its orbit before it stands at its mark again. All humankind are affected by the revolution of the planets, this is the same astrological faith.